Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Jeffrey Breslow, game designer of Masterpiece, Ants in the Pants, and other famous games, Hall of Famer and author of A Game Designer's Life. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Yesterday in the synagogue, we observed the Sabbath called Shabbat Nachamu, which means the Sabbath of Consolation. This always follows the fast day of Tisha B'Av, the commemoration of the destruction of the first and second temples in Jerusalem, as well as other days of great national tragedy for Jews, of which we have had so many during our long, complex history. The name for this Shabbat comes from the selected Haftarah we chanted yesterday, taken from the writings of the great prophet 2 Isaiah. It begins with the words, Nachamu, Nachamu, Ami, literally, be comforted, my people, says your God. One of the most beautiful phrases in Hebrew is the one that signifies compassion. It's used throughout the Bible, and it is there at the beginning of our Haftarah of Consolation on this Shabbat of Consolation. Dabru al lev Yerushalayim. It reads literally, speak to the heart of Jerusalem. Now remember, Jerusalem was already destroyed at that point. The city was being used to represent the entire remaining peoplehood of Israel, you know, the Jews. That idiom, speak to the heart, is meant to convey comfort and understanding. It's employed in a variety of places throughout the Bible in which speaking to the heart expresses a connection that creates comfort. And it teaches a beautiful lesson. At times of loss and destruction, how are we able to bring consolation? The answer comes from that phrase, Vayedaber Alev, speaking to the heart. It means essentially connecting and conveying compassion and care. It means letting someone we care about know that they are not alone, that their hearts do not suffer in isolation. A great lesson indeed, but also an incomplete lesson. For what is compassion really? Is it simply empathy, making it clear that none of us is truly alone, helping a sufferer to feel cared about? That's surely a good thing, but can compassion be even more? 5 years ago, during a trip to the Himalayas in northern India, I had the privilege of meeting the Dalai Lama. While I heard him speak for a number of hours, his essential message was then, as it has been throughout his long and extraordinary career, about compassion. According to the Dalai Lama, compassion is the highest form of human action, the greatest goal for any sentient being. He has put it this way, love and compassion are necessities, not luxuries. Without them, humanity cannot survive. The whole purpose of religion is to facilitate love and compassion. Love and compassion are the true religions. Compassion and happiness are not a sign of weakness, but a sign of strength. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Now, compassion in Judaism, at its heart, is active. It's more than simple empathy. It is taking action to relieve the suffering of others. That's an ethical imperative to try to improve the situation, to fix the wrongs that cause suffering. In the words of 1st Isaiah and last week's Haftarah, compassion should motivate us to seek justice, relieve the oppressed, uphold the orphan's rights, take up the widow's cause. That's a powerful message. We heal another's pain not only by sitting with her or him or sharing that pain, but by working to change the injustices and inequities that caused the pain in the first place. In Judaism, the concept of compassion is deeply connected with doing mitzvot, actively trying to fix the wrongs that cause sorrow. We offer caring and hope, but our most effective means to console, to really bring comfort. These are not only emotional or even personal. They are more than empathy. They lie in the imperative to work to right the wrongs that caused such damage in the first place. In other words, the Jewish understanding of our true mission in life is to seek to fix the brokenness of our world. If we wish this to be a better planet, if we want things to improve, the way to do so is by both directly helping others, whether or not they can help us, and to seek to move this troubled world towards greater care and understanding. If we can really speak to the heart, daber alev, of those who are in need of compassion, which is, frankly, nearly everybody, right? We have the possibility to bring hope and healing to all of those around us. And what greater calling could any of us have? To play us in this morning on this theme of compassion, here's a setting of the prayer Rachem Na, Have Compassion on Us, recorded by Yossi Azulai.
רחם נא השם אלוקינו רחם על ישראל עמך רחם ועל ירושלים עירך רחם 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 David Meshichecha Ve'al HaBayit HaGadol VeHaKadosh Rachem, Rachem, Rachem Al Zion Mishkan Kevodecha Ve'al Malchut BeDavid Meshichecha.
That was Yossi Azulai's Rachem Na, Please Have Compassion on Us. Our guest this morning, Jeffrey Breslow, is a Hall of Fame game designer who came up with the idea for Masterpiece, Ants in the Pants, and Simon, among a variety of other wildly successful games still being played. Hear about how he ended up not only designing games, but as the Jewish CEO of a toy company when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Jeffrey Breslow is one of America's most prominent and famous game makers. He's actually in the Hall of Fame. You may not have known that there's a Hall of Fame for game makers. His new book is called A Game Maker's Life. He is the inventor and developer and then the head of the company that produced a lot of games that you probably have played, from Masterpiece to the electronic game Simon. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here.
So I'm going to ask you a difficult question. What kind of a job is this for a nice Jewish boy?
Actually, a wonderful job. You know, I mean, what's interesting, a lot of Jews in the toy industry. I mean, the history of in our country, Mattel, Ideal, Kenner, Louis Mark, a great many Jewish people started toy companies a long time ago. So it's not unusual. And my boss was Jewish, who hired me a long, long time ago. So, and he tried to manufacture toys, but he kept losing his ass that I'm not going to do that anymore. Yeah, I mean, he actually looked at the book business, he looked at the record business, and said, I want to try and do that in the toy business. In other words, come up with an idea, show it to somebody, and license it for a royalty. And he did that in the late 60s, and it wasn't, and the one he started with was Ideal Toy. And that was also another Jewish toy company.
Another Jewish toy company, yeah. Yeah, you know, it almost begins to sound like it was a Jewish industry.
Early on, it certainly was. I think the only ones not were, as early on, Kenner was, Milton Bradley and Parker Brothers. But other than that, the Hasbro, another one, I keep missing them. But there's a whole list of, I would guess, close to 10 companies, very big companies.
So tell us how you got into it.
Well, I never grew up. That was the first thing. That was a requirement that I looked for somebody who wanted a job with me once I was running the company. But I, you know, I wasn't motivated as a kid. I mean, I liked to take things apart and mechanically and everything else, but I wasn't a very good student. And, you know, I graduated in the bottom quarter of my high school class. And at that time, I wanted to go to the University of Illinois. And if you were at the bottom of your class, you still got accepted. And my guidance counselor said, probably not a good idea once you start at a smaller school. So I went to Bradley University, and after a year, I was on terminal probation, which was not something my folks were delighted to hear.
That does not sound good.
And I took a trip to University of Illinois in Champaign. I borrowed somebody's Beetle, and a good thing I drove a stick shift. Otherwise, I would have become a toy designer. But the only A I got in high school was in art. I had a wonderful teacher and very nurturing. Anyhow, I went to the Fine Arts Building, and there was a display in the corridor of industrial design sophomore class. And there was a name, Ed Zagorski, the instructor. But what it was, there was a block of wood that was like a big stick of butter out of pine wood. And everybody was given the same block, and you had three cuts on the bandsaw, and then you glued the pieces together and then sanded it, and then painted it with automotive paint, and it was just beautiful designs, all that came out of the same piece of wood. It was quite extraordinary. Huh. And there was a door half opened, and his name was on the door. I knocked, and in 20 minutes, Ed Zagorski changed my life. And I said, I walked out of there, and I wanted to be an industrial designer. And the thing he said is that in design, form follows function, okay? It's got a function, and then it can look beautiful, okay? If you design it, chair, it's got to be comfortable to sit in, and then you can make a beautiful chair, you know. So that was the mantra. And so I had to start over as a freshman. So the first year and a half of college went down the drain. Anyhow, I started as a freshman, basic design courses, and then I got Ed my sophomore year, and it was amazing. And, you know, he gave us projects, not to design something, but how to think and how to, you know, I mean, it was amazing. And bottom line, he mentored me for 65 years. I mean, we were dear friends, and he sent me, you know, he called me up and said, I got this young kid graduating, and I hired this guy, and he ended up being the president of the company when I left the company. So he supplied me with designers that he thought would be good toy designers.
It's a fantastic inspiration, you know, a great teacher story, really a great teacher story.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. And I did mentoring classes in Champaign, you know, later on. I went down there and tried. And what I learned is that the mentee has to grab a hold of the mentor. Ed wasn't looking for anybody. He was just talking to me.
Right.
And I grabbed a hold of him and never let go for 65 years. And we were dear friends.
We will talk much more with Jeffrey Breslow about how he invented games, how he became the head of his company in tragic circumstances, and his book, A Game Maker's Life, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a fabulous array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives each day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation, northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimcha.Tucson.org, BeitSimcha, Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary safely and in person. Call 520-276-5675 for information. If you have religious school-age children or grandchildren, join us for Splash Into School coming up today, Sunday, August 14th. Find out about our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, Torah Tikes, Confirmation, and Teen programs in a fun, relaxed setting. That's 520-276-5675. Beit Simcha Synagogue's located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us Friday night or Saturday morning. You can come in person or online at our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Friday nights at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. Access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. Our fantastic religious school is available in blended formats too. Some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and of course the coming High Holy Days, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing Jewish congregation and community in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at tojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, tojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, toojewishradio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. Post a rating, review Too Jewish wherever you listen. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Algeria, and you brought us up to the enormous growth in the Algerian Jewish population after the French took over, all the way up until the dawn, dawn is probably the wrong word, the beginning of World War II.
The eve.
The eve, let's say. The eve of destruction. in which the Algerian Jewish community was perhaps 140,000 people. By the way, I should note there's some very famous Algerian rabbis who are great scholars.
Oh, yeah.
A very rich and deep Jewish community there. Tell us, you know, what happened to this French possession in the period between, you know, 1939 and, well, I guess today.
Okay, so very interestingly, the Vichy regime, which was basically the French who were sympathetic to the Nazis and collaborators with them.
Pétain and the whole thing implemented
all of their anti-Jewish laws. The Vichy regime didn't last very long in Algeria. It was gone by 42. And that was due in large part to a ferocious French resistance, which starved a lot of Jews. So a lot of the Jewish population in Algiers actively resisted the Nazis. And there was something called Operation Torch. And then, of course, the Allies landed. And Algeria was one of the first parts of France to become free. So nonetheless, of course, Jews suffered, particularly in terms of having property confiscated. And it wasn't until many years later, like the 1990s, that the Germans acknowledged that Algerian Jews were also victims of the Holocaust and also deserved compensation. So all those claims, conferences, and all that eventually extended to Algerian Jewry, even though, you know, luckily only a tiny percentage of Algerian Jewry was actually deported and killed. So after the war, there were almost as many Jews as there were before the war. You know, it might have gone from 140,000 to 135,000 or something, but was not a dramatic difference the way it was in so many countries. And even when Israel gained its independence in 1948, there wasn't a mass exodus of Algerian Jews because there weren't the kinds of demonstrations and persecutions that there were in other Arab countries in the wake of 1948. When the mass exodus took place was at the end of a very long, very bitter war between Algerian freedom fighters, who might also be considered in some quarters terrorists, the National Liberation Front, the FLN, and the French. And both sides used barbaric methods. Both sides were guilty of horrible war crimes and really
torture,
unspeakable.
I
don't want to catalog
stuff.
It because yeah. It's awful.
Yeah.
You know, it makes somebody lose the contents of their stomach if they heard it all. But both the French and the Algerians were guilty of these excesses. And eventually, if you don't know France, you won't know how significant this is. But for a very long time, discussing the French role in World War II was taboo in France. It just wasn't done in polite society. It wasn't done at the table. And because they spent the first decade after the war pointing fingers at each other. You were a collaborator. No, I was a résistant and whatever. And everybody denied cooperating with the Nazis.
Of course.
So this was just a taboo topic. That taboo was quickly replaced by talking about the war in Algeria because the French had so much shame about their role there and because they lost a 12-year war from 52 to 64. And when they finally left, most of the Jews left with them. So that today in Algeria, there might be 100 Jews. Mm. And all the synagogues have been converted to mosques or libraries. So there's one big mosque in Algiers. It used to be the main synagogue, which is called the Mosque of the Jews.
Fascinating. And, you know, not unusual end to a Jewish community. And of course, there's Algerian Jews and people descended from Algerian Jews, many in France, some in Canada, some in Israel, all the places you might expect French-speaking Jews to move.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A secretary, a paralegal, and Levy, a partner in a big city Jewish law firm, are walking through a park on their way to lunch. They find an antique oil lamp on the ground. They rub it, and a genie comes out, poof, in smoke. The genie says, I usually only grant 3 wishes, so I'll give each of you just one. Me first, says the secretary. I want to be in the Bahamas, driving a speedboat without a care in the world. Poof, she's gone. In astonishment, me next, says the paralegal. I want to be in Hawaii, relaxing on the beach with my personal masseuse, an endless supply of pina coladas, and the love of my life. And, whew, he's gone. You're next, the genie says to the law partner, Levy. And the law partner says, I want those two back in the office immediately after lunch. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. As a people, we Jews are good at many things. At kvetching, of course, at Lashon Hara, gossip, telling people things we shouldn't, at eating. Perhaps most importantly, we Jews are good at asking questions. In fact, the greatest of all Jewish questions will be asked in this coming week's Torah portion of Akev, third portion in the book of Deuteronomy. It reads, And now, Israel, what does God ask of you? The passage in Akev then answers this great question, that you have awe of the Lord your God, walk in all of God's ways, love God, and serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. This big question, what does God ask of you? And Akev's answer begin a series of statements in Jewish tradition, attempts to distill from our large moral storehouse just what the essence, the ikar of Jewish ethics really is. What is it that God wants? What's the true standard we need to uphold to be considered morally good? The section in Akev lists a few things we need to do for God's sake. First, revere God. Second, walk in God's ways. Third, love God. Fourth, serve God with all our hearts and souls. And fifth and finally, we're told that we must guard and do all the mitzvot, the commandments of God. It's a clear and powerful list, but it was just the beginning, not the conclusion of this exploration. The great prophet Isaiah distilled these terse commands from our Torah portion into a more concise version. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, relieve the oppressed, uphold the orphan's rights, take up the widow's cause. Isaiah's version was more pragmatic than the earlier text and shorter. First, seek justice. Second, relieve the oppressed. Third, fight for the widow and orphan. Of course, to start doing any of those, you must first stop doing evil and try to do good. That is, you must first study so that you can properly know what goodness consists of. A century after Isaiah, the prophet Micah refined the formula again. He asked, What does God seek of you? Only to do justice, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. A simple, clear, beautiful formulation of ethics. And finally, Hillel, 400 years later still, just a little over 2,000 years ago, said it most concisely, Do not do to others what is hateful to yourself. All the rest is commentary. Now, go and learn. The Jewish assumption is that you'll adopt one of these magnificent formulas for your own life. Whichever one you choose, it will be a high standard for how to live, but one that each person can achieve, if he or she chooses to do so. After all, that's what God wants, and so should we. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest this morning, Jeffrey Breslow, a Hall of Fame game designer, tells us the rest of his story as the youngest head of a nearly all-Jewish-led popular toy company, how it rebounded from tragedy back to creativity. It's all fascinating. Hear about it when we return in a moment on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The Jewish Agency, a historic and important organization that's rescued many Jews from Russian oppression for many decades, is leaving its physical presence in Russia. There has been progress regarding tensions between Russia and Israel thanks to the mediation of Israeli President Isaac Herzog. But the heads of the Jewish Agency have decided to officially end being present in Russia. The implications of this exodus of one of the most symbolic Jewish organizations in Russia and its activities bringing Jews to Israel, well, they are significant. Whatever can be done online, such as dealing with the Aliyah process, will continue to take place. but no more Jewish agency in Moscow, St. Petersburg, or elsewhere in Russia. The Jewish Agency will operate all of its work on Aliyah from Israel, online or by phone. The problem is that there will be no way to encourage Aliyah from Russia, something the agency's been doing successfully for many decades. In addition, the Jewish Agency will change its model of operation to those of other philanthropic foundations. We won't operate any physical activities in Russia after our exodus, but we'll fund local activities or send temporary educators from Israel to assist with Jewish life. The agency currently has 200 employees in Russia and three full-time Israeli shluchim, emissaries, whose contract ended during the summer. They aren't expected to return to Russia. The Jewish Agency hasn't found replacements for those shluchim who run activities in Moscow and St. Petersburg. The consequences are that there will be no Aliyah activities in Russia in any form. No one can give information about Aliyah. There will be no physical representative. You'll have to connect to the Global Center in Israel online. The Jewish Agency has operated Sunday schools around the country and camps and has supported local communities to organize events for Jewish holidays, youth activities to promote participation in long-term programs in Israel. After Vladimir Putin and his minions threatened to stop the operations of the Jewish Agency in Russia, Israeli President Isaac Herzog spoke with the Russian dictator as part of an effort to overturn the decision. While the two presidents discussed bilateral matters, the challenges of the Jewish diaspora and the ongoing crisis with the agency, well, those were not resolved. Putin told Herzog that he remains committed to commemorating the Holocaust and promised to stand by Jewish communities in Russia. Of course, this is Vladimir Putin. His word is worth very little indeed. Ever since the news broke that Moscow ordered the Jewish Agency to cease operating in Russia, there has been anticipation that the Israeli president would speak to the Russian dictator. Last week, a meeting between an Israeli delegation sent to Moscow and Russian officials from the Justice and Foreign Ministries hit a dead end regarding the agency's presence in Russia. A senior official at the Jewish Agency said the agency has no intention of closing down its activities and leaving Russia. We will adapt ourselves to the requirements of Russian law. Operating within its framework, we will continue to be present and operate in Russia as far as this is legally possible for us. However, a court hearing set for August 19th, during which the judges may possibly ban the Jewish Agency's activity in Russia, will still take place. This move by the Russian dictator, Putin, is part of the ongoing separation he has enforced on the Russian people. The Jewish Agency was integral to the escape of over a million Jews from the collapsed Soviet Union in the 1990s, and its ongoing efforts to encourage Aliyah to Israel, which has politely sort of sided with Ukraine during the Russian brutalization of that country, no doubt rankled the evil Putin. He prefers his Jewish oligarchs' home under his thumb, where he can selectively, you know, poison them without the fear of international interference. He certainly does not want his people, especially Jews, knowing there's an escape hatch out of Mother Russia. And, of course, Putin doesn't want Israel stepping in to sell natural gas to Europe, as Europe seeks to wean itself from suckling at the Russian pipeline for energy. Israel has vast natural gas reserves off its Mediterranean coast. It is now exploring a pipeline to Europe through Greece. Jews are once again being used as a pawn by Russia. A long history of that, of course. It's yet another sick and long-standing evil being revived by Vladimir Putin. In other news, in Israel, after more than 48 hours in which hundreds of rockets were fired from Gaza towards targets in Israel by Islamic Jihad, most all of them missing, a ceasefire brokered by Egypt took effect. That ceasefire marked a swift conclusion to a conflict that erupted earlier when Israel killed a senior commander of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the terror group that promotes the military destruction of Israel and is regarded as a terrorist organization by the U.S. and the European Union. Islamic Jihad leaders vowed to retaliate. Over the next 2 days, sirens blared frequently in Israeli towns near Gaza and occasionally farther afield in Tel Aviv and outside Jerusalem. Nearly 1,000 rockets were fired from Gaza. Israeli officials said the Iron Dome defense system intercepted about 300 of them. Most of the rest that fell within Israel landed in open areas. Meanwhile, Israeli armed forces struck targets in Gaza. Within 2 days, Israeli leaders said they killed the entire leadership of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, preventing an offensive they said the group had planned. According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza, at least 44 Palestinians were killed, possibly including some children. Israeli officials said the children died when Islamic Jihad's own missiles fell within Gaza, landing on their own people. Seeking to demonstrate its care in avoiding civilian casualties, the Israeli army released videos, some subtitled in English, showing pilots aborting missions when civilians were present. According to Israel's Channel 12, the head of the country's Shin Bet Security Services urged lawmakers to end the operation, called Breaking Dawn, after 2 days, before an accident or mistake complicated it. U.S. President Joe Biden released a statement welcoming the ceasefire, calling for both humanitarian aid to Gaza and timely and thorough investigation to reports of civilian deaths there. He added, "My support for Israel's security is longstanding and unwavering, including its right to defend itself against attacks. Over these recent days, Israel has defended its people from indiscriminate rocket attacks launched by the terrorist group Palestinian Islamic Jihad. The U.S. is proud of our support for Israel's Iron Dome, which intercepted hundreds of rockets and saved countless lives. I commend Prime Minister Yair Lapid and his government's steady leadership throughout the crisis." The Gaza campaign was the first military operation overseen by Lapid. He is a month into a five-month caretaker government before scheduled Knesset elections in October. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish, one of the, I think, really more unusual guests we've had in 20 years of being on the radio, exploring everything that Jews do in America and around the world. Jeffrey Breslow is a game maker. He's in the Hall of Fame for having developed some of the most famous games in American life, and I guess they've gone around the world. Tell us how you came up with your ideas. How about your first great idea?
Well, I got hired. I didn't get... Let me back up a little bit.
Sure.
We did one toy project in my sophomore class. And all the projects are jury graded, so it's very subjective. And mine came in second. It was children's modular furniture. I made a little prototype, and there were pieces that moved. And so you put these cubes together, and it was a chair, a stool, an easel. And the number one that came in was this blue box that had a buzzer and a little probe, and you stick the probe in the box, and it buzzed, okay? And John Spinello did that, and that came in first. It was fantastic. And John was on a GI Bill, and he was a little bit older than me. And I said, "John, what are you going to do with that?" He said, "I got an uncle in Chicago that works for a guy named Marvin Glass." I said, "What do they do?" He said, "It's a toy design company." I said, "You're kidding me, you know." So literally, John graduated ahead of me, went to see Marvin. Marvin wasn't hiring, and he gave Marvin, Marvin gave him $500 for the box, and John sold it. And at that time, tuition for a semester in Champaign was $380, so $500, John. And the box went on to become Operation Game. John never forgave himself. Anyhow, I went to see Marvin when I got done. I couldn't get a job, and I designed medical equipment and supplies for 2 years, only wanting to get into the toy business. And so I was designing toys and games on my own, ultimately got a interview, and the whole story's in the book, but I was making $5,500 a year at the American Hospital Supply, and I wanted $10,000. And I looked in the mirror saying $10,000. I got an interview with Marvin, and he liked my stuff. And he said, "You know, what kind of money are you looking for?" I said, $10,000 a year, looking him in the face. He said, "That's a lot of money for a kid your age." I said, "Marvin, I'm worth it." He said, "Okay, you got the job." And I was very good at coming up with ideas. And a year and a half later, he made me a partner. I made lists of things to begin with, you know, bird in the hand, ants in the pants, all kinds of other things. I made a list of these. The next thing I did before I even started, I went to Toys R Us, and I walked up and down the aisle. And I never had any kids at that time. I never had anybody to buy toys for except myself. And so I spent, after about an hour in the store, the manager came over and said, "Can I help you?" And I said,
I got a job. "What are you, a creep? What are you doing wandering around here looking at kids' toys?"
And he said, I told him these particular things were done by Marvin Glass. It was Rock and Sock and Robots. It was Mr. Machine and a bunch of things that were done before I was there. So he said, "Take your time. You can be." So every day I went back to the Toys R Us and spent hours looking at stuff, toys, games, dolls, everything. And later on, when I was running the company, if somebody was in a slump, I said, take the afternoon off, spend it in the toy store. So all the time, look at everything on the shelf. And that's a way of being inspired, because there's so much out there. You say, how can I come up with a new idea? There's all this stuff already. But it's very inspiring. So that was, so a lot of the games that I did came from saying, and it, you know, but one of the first one was Ants in the Pants, which is still around 50 years later.
Amazing.
It's amazing that it's still sells.
It's incredible.
The other thing, we were in the entertainment business, the toy business, okay? We were entertaining children. And the entertainment business is built on failure, okay? Making movies, making records, making TV shows, doing theater, fail, okay? And that's the good news and the bad news about working in the entertainment world. I mean, a studio makes 20 movies, two or three pay for all the ones that fail. And there's no way of knowing. I mean, that's the amazing thing. You get the best director, the best script, the top actor and actress, it's still a flop, okay?
Right, you know, right. You know, absolutely.
You know, so there's no, so when I hired people, and when I was there, you have to learn how to fail. We would generate, at Marvin Glass, we would generate in the course of the year 600 or 700 ideas.
Wow.
That we'd actually log a date. Maybe we'd work a day or two and say, oh, thanks, that's it. But we would show maybe 150 to our clients. Maybe, you know, we'd end up licensing, you know, 20 or 30 and four or five, you know, big hits paid for everything. That's how it was, you know. I mean, it was just, that's the nature of it. So the other thing that inspires creative people, not just in my industry, is pressure. Okay, you got a deadline, you're a painter, yeah, you got a show coming up, things start to happen.
It's true in my business too. If the holidays don't come around, you don't write your sermons.
Absolutely.
You know, it's absolutely fascinating, the whole way this worked and the dynamism of it. Tell us how, but you know, not all toys are just entertainment. I played Masterpiece as a kid. Tell us, you know, I learned a lot about fine art. It made me appreciate things. Tell us about that.
First of all, most games, okay, are a combination of skill and luck, okay? There are a few exceptions. Chess is only skill.
Chess skill, you know, yeah.
If you're a better chess player, you're going to beat me all the time, okay? There's no luck in the game. But all the other games, okay, for the most part, are skill and luck. And the fun of it is, if you win, if you beat me, you got better cards. If I win, I was smarter and more skillful, okay? That's a good game. And that makes you want to play it again, okay? You play it, I didn't get the right cards, blah, blah, blah. So you need the right balance. Now, Masterpiece, because I was very interested in art, I had an idea for an art game. And I went down to the Art Institute and I bought, you know, 40 postcards, okay? And came back. And then I made value cards, okay? So one or two were worth $1 million and two were forgery. But every game you attach the card, the value card, to the painting. So the next game, that painting was a forgery. The next game, that same painting might have been worth $1 million. But it wasn't stuck on the painting. Now, the fun of the game was to try and screw your other players, of course, okay? Now, if you bought a painting from me, and it was a forgery, and I said, no, this is a very valuable painting. When you bought it, you had to keep a straight face because you were going to try and sell it to the other player who didn't know. So what happens now, you bought it from me, you got stuck. I'm not saying anything, you're not saying anything. Now, when you sell it, I'm bidding on this thing, okay? And at some point, I'm going to stop my bid and stick one or the other. So that was the gist of the game, you know, in addition to learning about fine art and paintings and everything else, which was fun. But the game played well because it changed every time. And the fun of it was, you know, you got stuck and now you're going to try and stick somebody else.
Yeah. All of the games are fun and interesting, but in the middle of this, you know, game making experience, here you are working for Glass, and a horrific tragedy takes place. Tell us that story.
Well,
I mean, it's not all fun and games, right? Quite literally.
But I'm saying it happens all the time today. The difference between today and way back then is everybody knows about everything today. There's a tragedy on the other side of the world, on the other side of the country. You know about it. So this has been going on, sadly, for a very long time. And this was an employee that worked for us for 7 years. He was an electrical engineer. My partner brought him in from another company. He was our only electrical engineer. he just delivered a project with another designer. They went to New York to deliver this project, and they went out and had beers. They celebrated, and he comes to work one morning with two guns, and there was no way. He was a quiet guy. I mean, he wasn't, you know, aggressive in any way. I mean, it shocked everybody. But he walked through the building. He came in late. The partners, Marvin had died, and Anson Isaacson was the senior partner that Marvin brought in. Because Marvin had a stroke, and he was only lasted 6 months. The whole thing kind of fell apart. He died pretty young. He died at 59. But so I spent 7 years with Marvin. Anyhow, we had partners meeting. There were 10 partners, and we typically had a meeting every morning. So everybody, and we had close to 70 people working for us. It was a pretty big company. Not only 70 people, but probably 180, 200 family members and everything. So we supported quite a few people with the design business. And Al comes to work with two guns, and he, you know, walks up to his office, and, you know, whether he had them in his pockets, I mean, nobody paid any attention to him. There's a guy that came to work every day for 7 years. It wasn't like he came in and people knew what was going to happen. And he walked up, and then he walked to the back door of this office and opened the door, and he expected to see 9 or 10 partners. But the meeting had broken up. I was there with Anson and Joe and myself. And the phone rings, and it was our receptionist. And she said, "It's Jim Salem on the phone." And she sensed I didn't recognize. She said, "He called you a week ago talking about Evel Knievel." I said, "Okay, put him on the phone in the office next door." I could have said, "Take a message." And if I said, "Take a message," I'd be dead.
Yeah.
Okay. But it was that unimportant of a call. He was a nice guy, and the meeting was broken up, and I said, put it in the next. I went in the office, which was at a little angle and across the corridor, and I'm on the phone, and I hear a shot. And it wasn't like, it was a noise. I didn't think it was a gun. I mean, our place, nobody got into our place. It was very secure. You know, we had cameras. I mean, it was, it was just a private company. We had no public access at all. There was no reason for anybody to come in and, you know, except the mailman downstairs or somebody else. Anyhow, I hear the noise. I said, "Hold on a second." And I put him on hold, and the back door was open. And I know I closed the back door. But when I walked in, he shot Anson twice in the face with a 9mm and shot Joe 3 times in the chest, and Joe looked and fell, and he died on the way to the hospital. Anson was dead immediately. I ran out the front because I thought somebody came in. I mean, I didn't connect the open door with anything else. I ran out the front door screaming to Pauline, and her office was, her desk was quite a ways, and there was an elevator, so she didn't hear anything. These were very heavy closed doors. Then people started running from the other side about shooting going on. And then I realized at that point that it was still going on, or it had been over, but it's going on in the back as well. But when he got to the office, he, shot people down the corridor. I mean, he, Don Nick's bullet severed his spine, and he was in a wheelchair the rest of his life. Another one was shot at, but didn't hit him. He shot Kathy. She was just sitting at her desk and killed her. Across the hall from his office was his friend, and he shot him a couple times. He shot him, and he screamed at him. He shot him again. When he turned to his office, he put the gun to himself and killed himself, and that was the end of it. You know, I mean, it wasn't, but the police were there immediately, and, I ended up, I went back in the office and called my dad, called my wife, and I said, "You're going to hear stuff on the radio. I'm okay. It's over," and blah, 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 you know. And then the detective came in, Joe DiLeonardi, who was the chief of the Chicago Police Department, because there was a station literally around the corner from us at the time. And he said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm one of the partners." He handed me some notes. In the notes, he said, they took them out of his sock, out of Al's sock. And on the notes were scribbling about the conspiracy of the company out to get me, and my neighbor's trying to take my wife away, and the blacks and Mexicans are taking over the city, and, you know, just rambling. And why he took his sock off when the body was at my studio, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But, my name was number two on the list of those involved in the conspiracy, and Anson, the managing partner, was number one, you know. So this happened on a Tuesday. We had a week of funerals, and what surprised me is that half the people went to Al's funeral. I wouldn't go, but they said that wasn't Al. That wasn't the guy we knew for seven years. So, you know, I mean, anyhow, we had a thriving business, and I was the youngest. I was 33 years old when this happened. And one of the other partners who had been there before me and was older than me and a terrific designer, nobody wanted him to run the business. They thought that he wasn't, you know, couldn't do a job. So I ended up getting the job by default. I thought Harry should run it. He was kind of the assistant there, but nobody wanted it. So I got the job running the company at 33 years old. I was scared shitless. You know.
Yeah, I'll bet. Absolutely. Terrified. Sure.
I was lucky enough to find somebody over the weekend that had experience with group disasters or something. And the person came in and he said, we have to get everybody together on Monday and talk about where you were and why you weren't killed. And if people aren't going to talk about it, they're going to have trouble processing and dealing with it. You got over and over and over again. It's the only way to get past it. I was in the bathroom. I stepped out for a phone call. I was downstairs. I wasn't upstairs. You know, I mean, I wasn't in my office. You know, you had to go through the process. But it's still, you know, the fact that we were in a fun and game business, you know, it was tough, you know. But we prevailed, you know. And shortly after this is when we came up with Simon, which was just a boon for us. You know, it was early on in that business. Anyhow.
No, it's an incredible story. I know we're running a little long, but I have to ask you, you have a story about one incredible mistake you made. It was this ridiculous idea that somebody had, which involved turtles. Can you tell us about that?
You can't pick them all. Okay. And the truth of the matter is most of the big hits would have never tested well. Barbie, you know, 1958, a mother going to buy that doll? Absolutely not. No way. Cabbage Patch, ugly doll, never sell. Rubik's Cube, you can't even solve it. And it's $10. A puzzle's $2. Never. I can go down the list, okay? So a guy comes in and says, there's this underground comic book. These two guys from New Hampshire, wrote this thing, and maybe there's a toy in there. I said, what is it? He said, well, it's kind of strange. I said, you can tell me. He said, it's four characters that are stand-up turtles, and their names are Michelangelo, Donatello, Raphael, and he says, I said, I know who they are. I studied art history. He said, no. But in the comic, it's Donnie, Mickey. I said,
Raffy, yeah. I mean, what's going on here?
I might have said, you're kidding me, okay? And then he said, well, they're trained by a sewer rat in New York, and they fight karate. I said, come on. This sounds like a terrible idea, okay? And went on to be one of the great toy products of all time. So everybody has a story like that. You're not going to make them all, you know. I mean, it's just so I can still laugh at it. But sure. I'm sure these two guys that did this have their own island somewhere, their own airplane.
Yeah, absolutely. Whoever chose that did okay.
You know what? It was the company that did it was Playmates. What a major company would have, Mattel, Hasbro, they would have never.
They all turned it down or never would have taken it, right?
Yeah, it was.
I want to thank Jeffrey Breslow for a wonderful visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called A Game Maker's Life. Where can people go to find out more about
you? Amazon. It's on Amazon right now.
Absolutely. The place for basically buying everything in the world, including toys. Thank you so much. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Lynn Julius, author of Uprooted, How 3,000 Years of Jewish Civilization in the Arab World Vanished Overnight. Don't forget, join us, Congregation Beit Simcha, in person each Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too. 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush live in person and on our Facebook page. play out this morning comes from the Yama Ensemble of Israel. It's their setting of Psalm 104 using traditional instruments of the Middle East. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.